This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. There were big developments in regard to Syria over the weekend, including the visit of Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton to the Turkish capital, where she met with the foreign minister and uttered the words, no-fly zone, among the many possibilities amid the clandestine war that is being waged against the government of Syria seeking the overthrow of the leader Bashar al-Assad. We'll be speaking about those developments today with Dr. Jennifer Lowenstein, the Associate Director of the Middle East Studies Program at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Also today, we will hear from Rick Rossoff. He's the head of Stop NATO. He will present an overview of the regional developments surrounding Syria. All that and more, including Hillary Clinton, on today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, the program originating at WBAI. And there were major developments in regard to the combined attack on the government of Syria from clandestine operations supported by the Central Intelligence Agency and by NATO through the Incirlik Air Base in Turkey and the city of Adana, where major Contra supply routes have been set up. Scattered fighting continues in the north of the country near the Turkish border. And adding to that was a collaboration between Turkey and the United States, the host of the Incirlik base, in which Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton said that she was contemplating a no-fly zone and securing of the northern takeover of the nation of Syria by the various organizations under the banner of the so-called Free Syrian Army that are being highly funded by the United States, by Saudi Arabia, trained and assisted by Qatar, including the Cyrenaicans from Libya and elements that are characterized as al-Qaeda. This has been one spectacular week, and we're now joined by Jennifer Lowenstein. Welcome back, Dr. Lowenstein.
Thank you very much.
Well, what kinds of alarm bells might have gone off as you reviewed the visit of Secretary of State Clinton to Istanbul for further collaboration on the destabilizing of Syria?
Yeah, I think for me, it's a really troubling sign, because I think up until very recently, the United States has been kind of dragging its feet in the sense that it's not ready to jump in and fund and arm and train rebels because it's not really sure that Assad is so bad compared to what kind of a regime could be established if he's gone, if he's removed from power. Assad has worked very well for the U.S. for a long time, despite the fact that Syria belongs to this axis of the Shiite axis or the axis of terror, whatever you want to call it. Bashar al-Assad has been, you know, in many ways, just what the United States wants and needs in that part of the region. With all of the changes that have taken place in the last week especially, what we're seeing is a change in the administration in the United States that is fairly substantive in my view. This could be a very dangerous sign, put it that way. I'm very nervous personally over what could happen in the region if the United States does in fact take these steps.
One of the most startling statements from Secretary Clinton on this weekend during her visit to Turkey was her putting on the table the prospect of setting up an American or a NATO-American or a regional no-fly zone in northern Syria. This is something that we saw most recently in Libya as the pretext or the prelude for the overthrow of the Libyan Arab Jamahiriya, and something we saw also in Iraq. What do you make of the prospect or excuses or reasons as stated for having a no-fly zone?
That's a great question, and I think, first of all, it's again, this is something that I find very troubling. Why? Because it suggests to me, first of all, that the United States does in fact believe that it can work with its NATO allies and its the friends of Syria, the so-called friends of Syria, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, you know, the Jordan, Egypt to a certain extent. I sense that the United States administration has crossed a line and that they are now trying to work behind the scenes with their allies to control who will get into power if, in fact, Assad is removed. And I do think that is the goal now. I don't think that there's much of a future for Bashar al-Assad. And to me, this is, as I said, it's a dangerous sign because we know from many, far too many episodes in recent and distant history in the United in the Middle East and concerning the United States that we can't really control the outcomes of our intervention any more than anybody else can. And this sudden shift, this what seems to me to be a belief that if they work closely and in cooperation with each other, they can see to it that extremist jihadi elements don't take the place of Bashar al-Assad, or that perhaps the Muslim Brotherhood doesn't come into power in Syria. It seems to me they now believe they can control the outcome of this revolution, and that is, I think, a very risky thing to believe.
I was also taken by the secretary's claim that the Obama administration is releasing nearly $100 million in what she characterized as refugee relief.
Mm-hmm.
And that is somewhat troublesome in that one does not know whether or not that money is actually going to the combatants or their support systems. In addition,
yes.
In addition to that, the Obama administration has okayed the collection of funds for the lobbying representative of the invaders, the so-called Free Syrian Army, with the mm-hmm. Treasury Department giving an exemption to this particular organization while it is preventing legitimate relief to go back to families in that part of the world. And third, President Barack Obama recently signed an executive order instructing the Central Intelligence Agency to take a more active support role for mm-hmm. these invaders of Syria. So although this may be coming more explicit, I'm wondering whether the Obama administration has really been soft-pedaling the overthrow of Syria, particularly in coordination with the $80 to $90 million that Saudi Arabia announced that it was sending in direct support to the armed mm-hmm. rebels and Qatar and
yeah.
other nations in the region, including NATO.
Well, and this plays right into what I was talking about earlier. First of all, the Free Syrian Army, we have to remember, this is not the heart of the popular uprising in Syria. That the popular uprising that began in March 2011 was brought about by many different people, but the serious, dedicated activists were very adamant about not involving violence, about not arming themselves, because this would immediately give the Syrian regime a pretext for coming down on the protesters all that much more strongly. They can now say, well, we're fighting to defend ourselves from, you know, armed insurgents who have sophisticated weapons and outside help. The Free Syrian Army, or at least parts of it, really wanted that, but they were in the minority. They were not the majority of the protesters coming out and demanding real positive change in Syria. So already we've managed to, in my opinion, hurt the very core of this uprising and damage it in such a way that they may never have another chance in in the future months, you know, in the short term, for a very long time. It's looking very bad. The other thing that strikes me is that, the U.S. is now much more open about telling the American public and the international community, the so-called international community, that it is, in fact, going to support the Free Syrian Army, that it is stepping up its aid to various groups for various purposes. I'm not convinced it hasn't been doing that all along, perhaps a little bit more indirectly. I don't think that the United States has at any time not been following this very, very closely. It's obviously a very crucial element, a crucial piece of the regional puzzle that we have to face when looking at the greater Middle East. What does this mean for the Alawites of Syria? What does this mean for the so-called Shia Crescent? What does this mean for countries like Saudi Arabia and Qatar, the countries that really dominate the Middle East under the aegis of the United States? I have really uneasy feelings about this, especially when we bring in the factor of Iran. I think this is, in a way, part of the ongoing war against Iran, and that has been one that has been ongoing for quite some time, undeclared, and that we have just taken it up a notch, and that could, in the long run, make things a lot worse than they are.
Jennifer Lowenstein is the Associate Director of the University of Wisconsin's Middle East Studies Program at Madison. And over the scope of history, we have seen this gambit before, where a government sees the radical, the Salafi, the most extreme Islamic fundamentalists as an armed tool to overthrow invidiously a government that is considered to be in competition. And finally, do you see a blowback here, as happened with the attempt during the 1970s and 80s to overthrow the regime in Kabul and the establishment of what would later become al-Qaeda? And how can that which has been used as an excuse for the war on terror and the dislocation of trillions of dollars from the American economy now be used as an ally, a comrade, a tool of statecraft? Do you see any blowback in the coming years and decades from this?
Absolutely. In fact, I was just having this conversation with somebody here in Madison where we were talking about the very word blowback and how this is another example of how U.S. intervention, U.S. involvement in a problem very much of its own creation could lead to circumstances in the future that will come back and hit us in the face very, very forcefully. We don't have control over what's going to happen as much as we like to think we do. And one key element that I like to emphasize, because it's so often left out of any kind of discussion, is that by intervening, by getting the support of the Free Syrian Army, by creating a no-fly zone, by having the Saudi regime and the Qatari regime and the Jordanian regime all together united on our side, it on the surface looks like, well, they're all ganging up on Syria and this is the end for Bashar and, you know, we've seen the end of it. I don't think so, because as usual, the United States has not and does not consider popular opinion, public opinion. As I said before, the backbone of the revolution in Syria has been ignored by the United States. These are people who didn't ever want an armed revolution. Along with that, we have to remember that the populations, the public opinion across the Arab world and in all likelihood, in Iran and other countries that are not Arab, public opinion is not with the Americans, nor is it with the regimes with which we are allied. So the blowback is going to be seen in two ways, or maybe three ways that come to mind: greater anti-Americanism, further extremism amongst people who previously were not as extreme as they may become, and a unification of popular dissent across the region that will absolutely oppose U.S., Saudi, Qatari, Jordanian, Free Syrian Army forces. In other words, you know, a public opinion poll taken not long ago about the United States and Iran in the Arab world showed that most people living day to day in the Middle East are much more afraid of the United States and Israel than they are of Iran. And so this could have the effect of pushing public opinion much closer to the Iranians in the long run. And in fact, I think that's already happening. And that is in addition to further radicalizing those elements on the right that are, or on whatever it is, I don't know whether you call it left or right in this case, you're going to see a further radicalization of people who are already moving into that in that direction, and you're going to see a unification and a much greater anti-American, anti-regime buildup amongst the population. I think particularly of places like northeastern Saudi Arabia, which is mainly Shia, for example. That is a tinderbox that most people have never even thought about or given. They don't even know about it. How are the people, the Arabs, the Shia Arabs of Saudi Arabia, going to react to a U.S., Saudi, Qatari coup in Damascus? How is Russia going to react? I have a very, very bad feeling about this, not because I don't agree with popular opinion. My opinion is probably closest to theirs, but because it involves so many world factors, or global factors, and that is potentially very dangerous.
Well, thank you so much for the analysis today, Dr. Jennifer Lowenstein of the Middle East Studies Program at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And Jennifer, how can people follow your work?
Well, I'm working on a book right now, so it's not very easy to follow it. I write op-eds and other opinion pieces in for Counterpunch, for Palestine Chronicle, for, you know, lots of online postings, and for newspapers locally and nationally as much as I can.
Well, keep up the great work, and thank you for joining us today on 5 O'Clock Shadow.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. And we note that President Barack Obama did make a campaign promise in 2008, among others, that he would unite the Muslim world. But he did not say how. The other tool of statecraft, aside from fundamentalism and terror and covert and clandestine invasions of countries that are most typified recently by Libya, Syria, Iraq, is the use of the big guns of the NATO military arsenal, which is increasingly involved in regional disputes such as this. And that question was tempered by the visit this weekend of Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton to Istanbul, Turkey, where she met with her foreign minister counterpart and, among other things, said that she is pressing for regime change and that she is contemplating the imposition of a no-fly zone. She trumpeted or heralded that trip just a week ago, just prior to her weekend visit to Turkey. And we now hear what she said over the weekend, but before that, we'll hear her build up to it from 1 week ago.
Well, let me begin by saying that, of course, we noticed the Prime Minister's defection yesterday. That's the latest in a line of such defections. And the opposition is becoming increasingly coordinated and effective. It now reportedly holds territory from northern Aleppo to the Turkish border. It's also seized regime weapons, including tanks. And it is a very difficult time for the people of Syria who are caught in this terrible violence. But I hope that we will look at the urgent tasks that I think confront the people of Syria and the international community and think through how we can address them. First, we must figure out ways to hasten the day when the bloodshed ends and the political transition begins. We have to be sure that we're working with the international community to bring that day about. And to be very clear of our expectations of both the government and the opposition about ending the violence and beginning the political transition. Second, we've got to address the desperate humanitarian needs of those suffering inside Syria and those who have fled. These are growing by the day. The UN and neighboring countries are asking for more assistance, and we have to work together to meet their needs. Third, I do think we can begin talking about and planning for what happens next, the day after the regime does fall. I'm not going to put a timeline on it. I can't possibly predict it, but I know it's going to happen, as does the most observers around the world. So we have to make sure that the state institutions stay intact. We have to make sure that we send very clear expectations about avoiding sectarian warfare. Those who are attempting to exploit the misery of the Syrian people, either by sending in proxies or sending in terrorist fighters, must recognize that that will not be tolerated, first and foremost, by the Syrian people. We have to think about what we can do to support a Syrian-led democratic transition that protects the rights of all Syrians. We have to figure out how to support the return of security and public safety and how to get their economy up and going. As you know, I'll be going to Istanbul to discuss these issues with the Turks. But the intensity of the fighting in Aleppo, the defections, really point out how imperative it is that we come together and work toward a good transition plan. And I would hope that everyone would recognize that the best way to get there quickest is to stop the fighting and begin a political transition to a better future for the Syrian people. We are really doing contingency planning. Sorting this out is what we have agreed to do. We have a very long list that we have gone through this morning on all kinds of issues, both before the inevitable fall of Assad and after. But we have to be very careful, and we have to do it in a way that always keeps in mind our goal, number one, is to hasten the end of the bloodshed and the Assad regime. That is our strategic goal. Regarding the planning, what the minister and I agreed to today was to have very intensive operational planning. We have been closely coordinating over the course of this conflict. But now we need to get into the real details of such operational planning, and it needs to be across both of our governments. Certainly our two ministries are coordinating much of it, but our intelligence services, our military, have very important responsibilities and roles to play. So we are going to be setting up a working group to do exactly that. And both the minister and I saw eye to eye on the many tasks that are ahead of us and the kinds of contingencies that we have to plan for, including the one you mentioned in the horrible event that chemical weapons were used, and everyone has made it clear to the Syrian regime that's a red line for the world. What would that mean in terms of response and humanitarian and medical emergency assistance? And, of course, what needs to be done to secure those stocks from ever being used or from falling into the wrong hands.
Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton, amid the flight of the Valkyries that may someday soon be augmented by the combined forces of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which is also coordinating the clandestine attack on the nation of Syria. This is 5 o'clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and the intervention of NATO in the region is a topic that was recently addressed by the head of Stop NATO, Rick Rossoff, speaking in Chicago.
I think a lot of what we're seeing here domestically in the United States is inextricably linked with the war cycle that began in earnest certainly in 1991 with Operation Desert Storm against Iraq, and has continued uninterruptedly in that period. We are talking about, for example, the war in Afghanistan, which will be 11 years old on October the 7th. You know, it's the longest war in the history of the United States. So what we're talking about currently is that an unprecedented series of acts of military aggression by the United States, not episodic, not occasional, but constant and unrelenting. Last year, for example, the U.S. Defense Department, the greatest misnomer in the world. No, the U.S. Defense Department budget with, you know, set-asides for Iraq and Afghanistan on top of the base budget was $729 billion. That works out to over $2,300 for each of the 300 million citizens of the United States. This is now, in the fourth year, the worst economic crisis in the United States since the Great Depression, and we can afford to spend, or that is, the government can afford to spend, spend over $2,300 on every single citizen of the United States. Incidentally, adjusted for inflation, what are called constant dollars, that's the highest U.S. war budget since 1945, which is to say World War II levels. This is 21 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, 25 years after the end of the Cold War, with not a single country in the world presenting a realistic challenge, much less a threat to the United States. The ruling elite in this country has spent World War II levels of funds from people desperately needed for jobs, for education, for health care, for infrastructural development, for all the causes we know that money is needed, on weapons of destruction and on using those weapons to kill people. That's the backdrop we have to see the Syrian crisis within. This is not an isolated episode. The U.S. has been hell-bent on overthrowing the government in Damascus since at least 2005, which is to say at the point at which Syrian troops were withdrawn from Lebanon, and comments were made by various high-ranking U.S. officials that this was, in so many words, the beginning of the end of the government in Syria. In other words, this predates by at least 7 years, actually over 7 years, or 6 years, the beginning of the unrest in Syria last year. So we have to, get our causality straight on this one, which came first. Developments in the Arab world in North Africa and the Middle East in the spring of last year simply created the pretext for the United States and its Western allies to fish in muddied waters, to exploit a crisis, to advance its own geopolitical and ultimately its own military objectives in the Middle East and nationally. One thing we cannot miss, this is so significant, it doesn't surprise me the establishment press doesn't pick up on it except to go into typical diatribes. But recently, Russia and China, two nuclear powers, of course, and two permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, for the third time, vetoed a resolution introduced by NATO powers in the UN Security Council that was targeting Syria for what could have been what's called an Article 7 United Nations action, which could include military intervention against Syria. This is unprecedented that two permanent members of the Security Council have vetoed three resolutions on the same subject. Going back to October, there was a second veto in February and one again recently. The U.S. has responded. In February, in Russia and China, for the second time, vetoed the punitive and, one could argue, resolution that was going to be preparation for military actions against Syria. The so-called Secretary of State, America's top diplomat, referred to Russia and China as being despicable. That's her term. On April the 6th, at a so-called Friends of Syria meeting in Paris, Clinton invites you to go to YouTube and watch it, waving her arm in the air and acting almost like a banshee, said that the problem is that Russia and China, keep in mind, this is the world's second largest economy, China, one of the world's two major military powers, and the only one with a nuclear arsenal and a triad of delivery systems that is comparable to that of the United States, Russia, says about both of them, the problem is, and I'm quoting here, they are not paying a price. They have got to be told that they will pay a price. This is gangster language. This is what you expect from, some street gang member telling you you're going to pay your price if you don't, play along with the game. This is a point it's got to. Syria, in addition to what what's going on internally, and Syria simply as a topic in and of itself has become much larger now. This is the worst diplomatic and political to date confrontation with Russia and China since the Cold War. There's no question about that. And that the fact that both countries are being targeted simultaneously is something that has not occurred since before the Sino-Soviet split, 50 years ago. So this is the context we have to discuss these matters in. There has been a plethora of disinformation campaigns to, try to portray U.S. concern about developments within Syria, and particularly the well-being of the Syrian populace, is being another attempt to peddle a humanitarian intervention approach. And we've seen the results of these past humanitarian interventions. One need only go to Kosovo right now, the prototype for that, where the unemployment rate is officially in the area of 55 to 60%. Where there have been hundreds, if not thousands, of ethnic minorities savagely slain, At least 225,000 members of ethnic minorities chased out of the province, never to return. This is all under, by the way, the watch of NATO and the United States. The U.S. has built the largest overseas military base since the Vietnam War in Kosovo, Camp Bondsteel. So we know what humanitarian intervention looks like in terms of the results. We can also look at, we don't have to go back 13 years, we can look at what happened last year with Libya. Another humanitarian intervention. We now have the country riven with regional and ethnic and racial disputes. We have pogroms against Libyans who are of sub-Saharan ancestry, that is, black Libyans. We have another country that is going to find a hard time, if ever, being able to rebuild itself and reconstitute itself a nation. This is the plan in place for Syria right now. And after Syria, let's be clear about that. I'm jumping ahead, but I think this is also another context. If you will, this is a sequential rather than a geographic context. If the West succeeds in its objectives in Syria, which is to say overthrow of the government and implanting a puppet regime, as they've done in several other countries over the past years, Iraq, Afghanistan, Kosovo, Libya, and so forth, let there be no doubt whatsoever, this will not be the last humanitarian intervention and regime change campaign. They instead will be emboldened to take on yet more and yet more dangers. Likely candidates for such a regime change policy, Belarus, Zimbabwe, and right here, much closer to home, Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, Cuba, Nicaragua. Those would be the next likely target for this kind of campaign. And if it doesn't stop someplace, it's going to become increasingly more dangerous. The fact that the U.S. is willing, U.S. and its Western allies are willing to antagonize major powers like Russia and China, as they have, suggests they are so reckless, they don't care what the consequences are, they are hell-bent on achieving uncontested global domination, militarily, politically, economically, and otherwise. And, such a reckless policy has to be reined in because it's a threat not only to regional peace in the Middle East, but ultimately to world peace. Now, the situation in Syria itself. We're seeing a replay of a typical subversion campaign that's been used in the Balkans, was used in Libya last year, has really been used, to be honest, for decades, if not generations. Similar efforts were used in Central America, were used in Angola, have been used in other countries around the world where you divide and conquer, right? Where ethnic and religious groups are set against each other. And if you read the Western press, the establishment press, you're going to get the same crude, primitive, one-sided perspective on Syria, which is there's a tiny dictatorship of religious Alawites that have dominated the country regardless of a Sunni majority and so forth. That, number one, fails to take into account a very diverse mosaic of religious and ethnic groups within Syria. There are not only Alawites and other Shiites and Sunnis, there are Christians, there are ethnic Armenians, there are ethnic Assyrians. This is a very broad group, and it's not as simple as is being portrayed for us. For example, the suicide bombing that the United States endorses, I'm talking about the bombing in Damascus roughly a week and a half ago that killed four major government officials. The defense minister killed was a Christian. The deputy defense minister, if I'm not mistaken, was a Sunni. Assad's wife is a Sunni, and so forth. So this, this image we have of an religious minority, ruthlessly running a country at the expense of the majority, simply is not true. If we want a real scenario along those lines, we can look at nearby Bahrain, where some 70% of the people of a Shiite religious background being dominated not only by a Sunni minority, but by a medieval monarchy. That is one of the grossest violators of human rights and democratic rights in any conceivable sense of the word. But Bahrain is a major friend and ally of the United States. The Khalifa family, epitomized Western transparency and democratic values and so forth. As a matter of fact, the last defense secretary, Robert Gates, was in Bahrain visiting with the Khalifa family, you know, the royal family, the very day before Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates sent 2,500 troops in to help suppress peaceful protests by Bahrainis. So, I mean, I'm just, you know, mentioning these things by way of contrast so that we can really look at the Syrian situation, you know, in a realistic perspective and not, you know, fall victim to the one-sided, you know, accounts that are being rendered by government officials in the West and their ever-obedient media. Second of all, you've read it yourself, you've heard it yourself, you know, the expression that the road to Tehran, the capital of Iran, runs through Damascus. Not only is the U.S. exploiting the Syrian crisis and prolonging that crisis and adding to the amount of Syrian civilians who are killed on a weekly basis to challenge, confront, and they hope, isolate and humiliate Russia and China, they are also, you know, attempting by overthrowing the government in Syria to eliminate the only government in the Arab world that Iran could can consider to be a reliable ally at this point. That is, of the 22 members of the Arab League currently, Syria alone has a, there are forces in, you know, in other Arab countries, of course, that, you know, friendly relations, political parties, Hezbollah certainly, with Iran, but the only government that has such close relations is Syria. If the Syrian government is knocked out, Iran loses its own major, its only major governmental ally in the Arab world. So does Russia, which moreover has its only overseas military installation in, outside the former Soviet Union in Syria, in Tartus. So the West has a number of important geopolitical designs in terms of Syria. It wants to expedite and finish off, you know, a project that began really 11 years ago with the George W. Bush administration's announced initially broader Middle East, later greater Middle East, and then Condoleezza Rice as of 2005, new Middle East policy, which basically says, you know, the broader Middle East, let's get a picture of this, is not simply the Arab world. It extends from Mauritania on the Atlantic coast of West Africa to Kazakhstan, which borders Russia and China. That's the greater Middle East. And that's what, from 2001 onward, U.S. You know, government officials and policymakers have determined is going to be transformed in a manner that better suits U.S. Designs. So the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, the establishment of U.S. and NATO military bases in former Soviet Central Asia, in Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, military penetration of Pakistan, the drone war and counterinsurgency war inside Somalia, the drone war and counterinsurgency war within Yemen, the war against Libya last year, and the subversion of Syria right now are all part of that broader Middle East initiative, as it was originally called by the Bush administration. You know, the old saw or the old cliche that with the United States, political differences end at the water's edge has never been more true, I think, than the seamless continuation and actually escalation of this broader Middle East policy that went from the George W. Bush administration to the Obama administration and will be intensified yet further unless we stop it under whoever gets elected this November. So, in addition to the threat to Iran, Iran will be isolated, the U.S. And its allies include, incidentally, not just their European NATO partners. You know, France, Italy, Germany, and other Britain have participated in some of the other wars I've discussed, all of whom have troops in Afghanistan currently. It also includes, you know, a NATO's adjunct in the Arab world, which is the members of the Gulf Cooperation Council. And again, if any, you know, if we know people, and I'm sure we all do, you know, who believe for a moment that the U.S. is interested in fostering and expanding democracy in the Arab world, one need only look at the closest and most reliable political and military allies the U.S. and the NATO countries as a whole have in the Arab world, and they're the six members of the Gulf Cooperation Council. They are, to a one, theocratic monarchies. They are Saudi Arabia, Oman, Qatar, Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, and who am I leaving out? Kuwait. Now, during the bombing of Libya, about 2 months into it last year, the only other two monarchies in the Arab world, Morocco, which is on the Atlantic Ocean, Jordan, which you know, is nowhere near the Persian Gulf, applied for membership in the Gulf Cooperation Council. Jordan and Morocco were in Paris with Hillary Clinton to launch the war against Libya last year at a so-called Friends of Libya meeting. Now it's Friends of Syria. Tomorrow it'll be Friends of Iran or Friends of Venezuela or Friends of Zimbabwe or Friends of whomever. So that what the U.S. and its NATO allies have done is to bring together the eight monarchies in the Arab world into one fold. Qatar, United Arab Emirates, employed French and other NATO nations built warplanes for the bombing of Libya last year. Those two countries, as well as Saudi Arabia, are actively involved in the subversion campaign against Syria now. So we have to look at this new, I called it at one point, an unholy alliance, modeled after, the defeat of Napoleon Bonaparte in Europe in 1815, where all the reactionaries in Europe, all the monarchies, got together and formed the so-called Holy Alliance to make sure never again, would republicanism, much less socialism, rear its head in Europe, and that they would conspire against it. This is precisely what the U.S. and its Western European allies are doing in conjunction with the most reactionary, the most brutal, the most, definitively anti-democratic governments in the world. You saw recently where a member of the House of Saud died, and, Obama immediately picks up the phone to express the most heartfelt condolences towards our strategic ally in the Middle East. So this, just so we know how seriously to take this concern about, fostering democracy in Syria or any place else, it's a charade. Now, I made allusion earlier to the 11-year-old, Global War on Terrorism, which has been, if not officially, renamed Overseas Contingency Operations by the Obama administration. They certainly have better public relations people working for them. They come up with better names as they, continue firing Hellfire missiles into northwest Pakistan, where the death toll now is someplace in the neighborhood of 3,000 people, which is to say more people have been killed, arguably, in U.S. drone attacks in Pakistan, northwest Pakistan, just in the last 8 years, since 2004. Than were killed in the United States on September the 11th, 2001. Let that sink in. In the name of combating terrorism, and if we go back a little bit to 2001, we have to recall after the attacks in New York and Washington that Donald Rumsfeld, then Defense Secretary, stated there was something in the neighborhood of 63 countries harboring terrorists. And that a country that harbored terrorists was no better than a terrorist, essentially, and that the U.S. reserved the right to strike those countries. 63 countries is roughly a third of the countries in the world. We also have to recall, and I think this is relevant to what was discussed earlier today, that immediately at that time the Bush administration exploited the events of 9/11 to target, by no means, simply the countries that were harboring the sorts of suspects that he was accusing, but to go after every genuine liberation struggle in the world by branding them terrorist and somehow linking them with al-Qaeda. This included not only secular, but particularly Marxist political movements in countries like Colombia, Palestine, the Philippines, and elsewhere. So this gave the U.S. a chance, if you will, to finish off the Cold War. Much of what we've seen in the last 15 or so years has been just that. With no opposition, with the end of the bipolar world, with no former Soviet Union or socialist bloc or anyone else to stand in the way of U.S. expansion, not only has the U.S. built military installations in part of the world that, 10 or 15 years ago would have been absolutely inconceivable. For example, starting in 2005 and the following year, the U.S. has gained 8 military bases in Bulgaria and Romania. Those are the first U.S. military bases on the territory of former Warsaw Pact countries. 2 years ago, we set up an interceptor missile battery in Poland with 100 U.S. troops. I think yesterday was the third anniversary of the world's first multinational strategic airlift operation, which is based in Hungary. We now have bases in, as I mentioned, Kyrgyzstan, Afghanistan. U.S. has recently gained access to bases in Australia, Singapore. There's talk right now about the U.S. going back into Cam Ranh Bay in Vietnam. There's been talk from Filipino sources recently that U.S. military forces are going to regain the use of the Clark Air Force Base and the Subic Naval Base in the Philippines. U.S. already has base camps and troops fighting a counterinsurgency war in Mindanao in the Philippines. So what we have is, the Syrian situation right now, in a very real sense, this is a line that has to be drawn in the sand. Thus far, no farther. U.S. and allied efforts to topple one of the few governments in the world that they don't have complete control over, that is not a military, that has never been a military partner of the United States. It's almost alone in the Arab world in that respect. That we have to be as clear and unequivocal as we can be. No U.S. And allied military intervention in Syria, surely. No provision of arms and support to so-called rebel groups within Syria. A U.N. brokered, if need be, but some sort of neutral parties, to broker a solution within the country and to prevent this thing from blowing up into a regional conflict that only includes Iran, but would inevitably spill over the borders into Iraq, Turkey, and Jordan. Thank you.
That was Rick Rozoff. He is the director of the Stop NATO. He was speaking on Syria, NATO, and the Obama administration's continuing policy of global domination through covert and overt military means. And we thank our Chicago colleagues of the Pacifica Radio Network at station WZRD. And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. The program was produced by Chiago Brozo and engineered by Michael G. Haskins. We welcome your comments, contributions, tips, leaks, questions, and suggestions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.